provinces. Carl earlier said, are there any other kind of promises? And congratulations, Seamus. I do you a winner this evening. Broken promises. As we grow older, we become a debt collector of broken promises. It's not that the world means ill, but the world's options grow larger day by day. Too much hanging around by the likes of ourselves, and too much excitement, far too much excitement, by a world that rushes headlong to embrace new recruits. The young are beautiful and sanguine, that's for sure. As I was saying, I hate that you promised me long ago an exceptional copy of Ptolemy's Geographica, the one published by Hall of Bulls, with its elaborately coloured vellum map, that gift to you from Prince Eugene of Savoy. As for the 1480 book, printed by Letout of London, I let it pass. People forget, and I work all day in a faraway library. But my heart did leap when you left the penguin selected of Yevtushenko, the smell of campfire and the old Georgian wine. I've had it bound in vellum, like an original Jensen at Venice. And I take it with me on long journeys to the Kerry Mountains, to Shanghai, to the sea. Once, while reading it, a young woman approached me wearing Stuart plaid, claiming that her name was Larissa Fyodorovna, that the book was of her patrimony. I promised her the book, of course, before I fled. The fiction, the sea. My wife Catherine is absolutely loves the sea. That allows the Cork people, she loves the sea, you know, Kerry. There's a condition of being from Cork. You love the sea, Kerry. There's something I have to learn about Cork people. When I came from Waterford. In Waterford, we kind of just love our own city. Ardmore and Tramore and Cunger and Clonmany, etc. Anyway, fiction, the sea. You keep returning to the sea as if you've lost a bracelet in the water, or some such valuable and peaceful thing. It is part of the problem of being a girl, my mother often said. Such possessions have become windows and mirrors to call a woman back, to demand clothing. Or as Henry James said, for he was no mother, as the picture is reality, so the novel is history, and not as the poem is, a metaphor, and closed thing. Strange how I could never go back to that spit of sand, the sea warren of the Cunniger in Dungarvan Bay. For I would never want to deconstruct what was never whole, what was tempted and poorly given. What it was that I chased after among blue razor shells. But I digress, for this is about you, returning late in the summer to a wild and restless sea. It is you grown restless from the inadequate sunshine, turning back like a pilgrim to inhale the iodine of the far west. Going farther, as you must, to meet the sea halfway, the sea in its life being more entrenched than us and far more progressive. So what of your bracelet, then, and where did that come from? Nothing but salt at the very edge of summer before it slips away forever. Salt and sand that makes a kind of mirror. Nothing but salt is left on the hard pavement of the sea. And kelp too, and its iodine, all strewn on the cold water. As you figure and pick among things like a novel, the tide bathes your whitened toes, it advances and recedes. My own beloved, the sea's drawn paper kisses you. It is your favorite singer, giving us knowledge abundant and decay. Thank you. One of the people who taught me what it was to be a writer was a very elderly lady called Molly Keane, who just don't have a phone, but her phone will have to get better. Molly was just absolutely fantastic, because like myself, she just, we always admit actually that alcohol was an absolute blessing. I mean, people have all these worries about alcohol, you know, what they mean is alcohol abuse, because, you know, like, it's abusive, actually, to drive a car into a wall, you know, so it's abusive, actually, to be drinking, and don't like it anymore, but it's certainly fabulous to drink. Anyway, Molly had a heart attack, and had all these ovens on her age, where they kind of saved her life, and she was 89 at this stage. She came home anyway, and one day she rang and I answered the phone, and asked her how she was, and she said she was a struggle. This was a struggle. She was trying to write her final novel, Loving and Giving. She said she found a way of doing it, and that's the end of the book. Molly Keane. It was the most ordinary Irish evening at the end of a windy day, leaves scattering with the nonchalance learned early in the autumn of their lives, when the phone rang with the raspiest grumbles our old phone always had, the black one that blocked the small ships in Dennis's little maritime oil sketch by Mr. Atkinson, Cork, grumbling away until I picked it up, heavy as a cinema camera that the postman used to have, to record the Corpus Christi processions. I mean, processions before Ireland went to the dogs. The postman who once delivered a wrought iron bench from Fred Astaire. And picking up the phone, I heard her say, Molly, just out of hospital, after a near fatal heart attack, just out of hospital and straight back to work. Writing is so wearisome, she said. I find that lobster and peach champagne to the people going. And another one about Molly. The last poem in the first section of my new book, which should be out in October. Molly Keane considers Brigadier Fitzgerald. Brigadier Dennis was a great gardener in Waterford and a great friend of Molly's, totally mischievous. Molly was mad about him because he had been a kind of dashing tank commander during the Battle of the Falaise Pocket against the German Grenadiers. And he was with, he and two other guys ran into a Tiger tank one day during a battle because their own guns had jammed, the famous funny incident. Anyway, Molly was part of idolized these kinds of men, you know. But anyway, Dennis loved her idolization and used to bring her flowers and herbs and everything. Dennis was about at this stage 93 and Molly was about 89. Because they could afford drivers and peach champagne, they just kept going, you know. Molly Keane considers Brigadier Fitzgerald. I am sitting here by the sea with a bunch of thyme, quiet as the stranger who held a reed for Harry Lyme. It is as cold as Vienna in October Ardmore. Rosemary in my hand wonders what I'm remembering for. Let's not remember too much of the last war, of the war before that took so many of the promises to fair. He picked these herbs in the black market of the first frost, rushing about as October did worse in the hilly gardens of Glenland. The last child kids back from bolting are so like the last lives of boys who came home in Musty. The astrakhan of his collar was neatly reattached by Anne, but his pepper still with an embodied thistle down. Time comforts us both with its godly motion. Time stained champagne with its peach liqueur. This bouquet is a Bellini of sorts. Only the war, and the war, and the war, men must want to fight, comes between the Vienna of days. yard more of light. It just occurred to me, like, when I put the poems together, that so many of them were about drinks, but fairly harmless drinks, like cocktails and things like this. Moonlight Cooler, which is Calvados and soda and all that sort of thing. Moonlight Cooler, 1948. It was the four frosted peach stem cocktail glasses, survivors of a disreputable bar in Minneapolis, that you were most proud of on the day of the Ballysaggot races, that day when a man claiming to be Bing Crosby, or Bing's brother, walked into the pub with Bing Bale's senator. Both wore dinner jackets. The senator's hunter had been lamed, hence the intense celebration to mask his personal sadness. Two women, elegant and loud, followed them indoors. Mrs. Nora Foley said they were like goddesses, the way they could move without moving, so to speak. She watched them with the eyes of a wet sheepdog as she threw lumps of turf on the fire. You were nonplussed when they mentioned the word cocktail, thinking to embarrass us all in the parishes of Ballysaggot and Lismore. Sure, every baptized Christian knew in the county in them days that on a moonlit evening in November, two ladies on the way to dinner at a big house would have the juice of one lemon, a little sugar, 2 Irish ounces of Calvados, and soda, all shaken with a bit of ice from O'Connor's fish store, and strained into, pardon the lack of highballs, your tiki stem cocktail glasses. Fit for anything. Okay, let's drink. This poem's called September Refugees. It just came to me one day as I was in the post office, actually at the Western Union counter in the post office, sending some money to one of my children, which is usually my parents my age too. And there were many African people there waiting in line before me. So I wrote this poem, September Refugees. The long electric line of refugees at the Western Union counter rumbles quietly in a shuffle of feathers, the way songbirds shuffle on a pillow of wires as they receive the few coins in late September sunlight. This is the hour of putting away every thought of drowning. An open boat that carried you through this life, impenetrable terror of the North Atlantic, misery of headwind, weakness of the will to live. Be a survivor, the counterterror of the wind you sail. Be a songbird. Because I can't tell you what you feel in this line of low conversation. I can only see the wound of the world bleeding into me. The wound is no longer Cucullin's wound, forget that. Here, I place my hand in a wound in Ireland now. I can only tell you what I feel when I see you assembled on the high autumnal wire of the minister's office. But here is Ray Lema being born on a train in Zaire, who came out of the womb singing, Isala, Isala. And here, Pierre Akendingue, persistent rain in Ceylon, Ceylon, flock and sing, survive. We met once before, you know, we made love and good marriages in another south. This is not the time to talk, not yet. A time will come to be together around a family that sings, as music is our best word. This is the first morning of a wind-born homecoming, shuffle of survivors, voyagers, mothers with the strongest will to live. And when the willow warbler in late September begins to sing again in a sudden, irrepressible outburst of hope. refugee center from my house, and I can look across the Kinsale roundabout and see the refugee center at Kinsale roundabout. Full moon over the refugee center. This is what it takes to come into your own kingdom. To stop banging your head against a liberty tree. To take something strong for your national headache. And find others around you, heads split open. This pilot moon that shines on a free Europe. With all the glamour of remembrance. All the night drops. Wireless signals. Replayed Casablanca. Shines also upon the Kinsale Road Refugee Centre. An inexhaustible moon it is, that scattered across the sky its silver, untranslatable dust. Okay, as the Super Mario said, one can be born in a stable and not be a horse. When I was young, many of my cousins and family were involved in the Fianna Fáil party. which is a strange term. But it's given me, I suppose, the memory of it. It's given some poems. These were published in 1984. I just read two of them. Shopkeepers at the party meeting. Listen to shopkeepers talking about the problems of land, the breaking up of an estate, or a new acquisition. Their conversation is proprietorial. To talk about a landlord's problem, to articulate his burden is their act of possession. They are owning the landscape briefly with the magical deeds of speech. The minister, on the other hand, has no such words. Whatever he has, his secret, even his desire, especially his desire. Shopkeepers move around the room, excited, in death, filling their dreams like thought. The president's men. There's dust on Mr. Deneen's boots. Where has he been canvassing, I wonder? What house has unlatched a half-day or carver's work to listen to his talk? My father knows the party polls. The roll calls the promise, the road we shall take when I am older in search of power. We'll find it like crests on farms of greens and vegetable water. The sound of bagpipe music, just listen. From my father's shoulder, I can see above the crowd Mr. Deneen's careful parade, men struggling to keep the roadway open, sunlight in my father's hair, the glitter of pipe and praise, the president's tragic day. And then a few years later, I wrote some more poems kind of in that vein as well. One that I kind of like, I suppose, because it's dangerous to write poems about this material because, like, it is current affairs material. Like, it's really difficult to put enough fixes on it so that it can become the material for you. Because like when you ever write, you know, about politics or about anything political, the desperate temptation is to immediately editorialize. Once you have your first three lines written, the first editorial comes into your head, you know, instead of the next letter or the next image. So it's incredibly difficult, I think, to write really successful poems about politics or political things. And like this is a typical one, which is a fairly decent poem, I think, but damaged, flawed, because as Patrick Hannon said, it has these kind of clever elements in it. It's called Shroud. And it's about the time the fantastic summer election was in 1989, I think. Election about 2 months after Charlie Haughey came back from Japan. And Charlie Haughey, when he was in Japan, met the Emperor of Japan, you know. And when he came home, he started acting like the Emperor of Japan. He really did start thinking he was a bounder, and he became imperial, like, and, you know. And it was more than Charlie Sharp at that day. It was kimono, like, it was very and just at the time, I remember, like, that's when things get turned bad, like, in politics it's interesting, politics is an organic thing, like an animal, like the atmosphere of a country is like an animal, you know, you can shake an animal and it gets angry and vicious, and like a country becomes like that, like, you know, the country's been shaken so much at the moment, I've got the really angry kind of dog, so like, Charlie became the kind of, you know, practical anger of the country. Just at that moment, the church also released its findings on the Turin Shroud, where it said that C14 dating of the Turin Shroud had established beyond doubt that it couldn't have been the shroud that wiped perspiration from the face of Christ, you know, Veronica's towel. Of course, the word Veronica is out of the metaphor, Vera icon, meaning true image, Veronica. Like, the church in its wisdom, which is a fantastic thing about Sabbath Catholicism, as many of us know, like, its marvelous kind of capacity to expand, rather like the Central Committee of the Communist Party, like, to expand the meaning of the truth so that it can be handled, you know. So, the church said that the shroud wasn't really, it wasn't a true shroud. But in fact, because it had been prayed to by so many faithful for hundreds of years, it now was itself a true object of veneration. The T-shirt space comes into great focus, like the lately used our Turin shroud. His speech is barely audible. The distress of failure cannot be hidden from a crowd. Crumbs are thrown at the gasping press corps. Images to fill up the emptiness of day. Gossip to feed the hunger. Running scared at the nothing in our lives, we praise a photographer's history. Flashbulbs tell us what we already know. It's been a tough campaign. Power has suffered a hair loss. The Taoiseach is ill, tired, becoming rough with those who question or disagree. The helicopter gunship of the canvas have left an unbearable ringing in his ears. A cynical decompression has taken place. A bulb flashes like a fresh blood stain. What is it that keeps him going? Is it power only? The sacred, the shroud of Turin that fills our man with a Jesus name. Is it that some deputy might touch the hem of his government and become a partner? Or some dark Magdalene white perspiration from his face? 10 years of anxiety following. Photographers hint at nothing more than martyr's waste. His tiredness. Television, our daily rhythm. Leave the quick instant. Elected Christ. Disappear without trace. This poem is called The Waiting Deputies, and it is about a particular night, a kind of a night I love in the country. Martin Cohen tried to take it away from us recently with his electronic voting machines, but when all the votes are collected from all the polling stations at the end of polling day, and for a night all the votes are there, the people have spoken. That's all anybody can do about it. The people have spoken, the votes are in the box. They haven't been broken yet. The fields haven't been broken. They're not counted. But like, it must be a lot nice about this. Like, they don't even know on surface what's happened. People have spoken. So anyway, I was driving around back from West Waterford, and there was the polling stations in National School, you know, near Ballysaggart and places like that, and Turin and places where kind of lights were going out, and you know, the guards are taking away boxes and stuff. And waiting deputies. Tonight I drive through my native county, 10 o'clock, all the canvassing over, the lights go out in the last polling booth. Incumbents await their final transfer. What is it my child was meant to say, I wonder? Just one version of the truth will out tomorrow when seals are broken. I drive through the lakes in Regnum as November rain drove through here for weeks. Posters lie torn in the exhaust town of Dungarvan and Lismore. The rainstorm of polling day has abated. The night speaks to me like an old detective. It protects the boxes and seals power. Who will be responsible for my childhood when the votes are counted? Where will the blame fall? The way I live now prevents any party from looking good. What I write, remember, feel, excludes me from their well-connected world. When I was poor, these men did business as if nothing happened. I was told they had power to offend us. They used to sail in and out of our demented terraces, the unopened boxes and steaming light. My parish sleeps on its pillow of rope, packed in between the river and the trees, ignores its grumbling questions, its point, its grief of favour. In the calm of night, they wait with me, the would-be deputy. Just three more then. Catherine, my wife, works in the prison. She's done a double life since, not this paycheck. She's been there over 20 years. Prison. You walk across, this is about going to prison, having spent the night minding our baby boy at the time. You walk across the compound on a clear day, the morning damp with dew, like dawn, like a squad car carrying you away from me. I watch the way you walk, elegant as usual, into the new prison studio. Out of one prison, into another. Last night, the determined prison officer, our son, poked at you with the warm baton of his bottle, his hay-hound fool. There is no escape from the love he has cast about us, and no reprieve. You were so free when I first saw you 10 years ago. When you walked, no woman ever had a walk as bold as yours. Out into sunlight from the pub door, I handcuffed you to talk. I was your holiday inquisitor. Embarrassed eyes gave you away. While others pleaded, I held you on remand, my fingers touching your hand. You withheld your address. But today, you walk through the new prison gate, your scarf beside me like a half sheet. This poem, this book, which I published, this is actually, I have a lovely publisher actually in London, Peter Jay, who stands with Press Poetry. They don't publish many books, but Peter loves books. He loves making beautiful books. And the last book he was kind of so happy with, he actually did a version in hardback for me, you know, which was beautifully printed. And it kind of keeps him happy, you know. I say to him, Peter, you really love my work, you know. He says, I do. I said, Peter, you kind of love my book so much, you want to finish it. Kind of typical conversation. That I've always had. Typical conversation. Anyway, these two poems are from this book. Nathaniel Murphy, the character in the book is Nathaniel Murphy, the kind of fiction in poetry and prose. Nathaniel the Cork Merchant. Yeah. I mean, it was doing all the research and reading all about Cork Merchant life in the 18th century that I suppose absolutely consummated my love of the city to make, you know, Cork and Trip. I always remember the French ambassador in 2005. I was bringing him through Cork and eventually I stopped in the middle of Antwerp, I think, in London. I showed him all the things. But, you know, he got Nathaniel Murphy in his sister's bedroom, 1798. When my sister ran away with Polissimo Shea, a clerk from the Quayside Custom House, who promised her a life of art in Boston, she abandoned her cherrywood escritoire in the cave of her bedroom. My father's gift was made by the cabinet maker, O'Connell. Like a buckle thief in Paul Street, I have removed the silver plate with her name, Letitia Louise, my only sister, so dear to me, as far from her native Irish kingdom as Mr. Singleton Copley is from the keys of Jacobin New England. And finally, this poem, he contemplates a stolen gazetto of Canova, Cupid and Psyche, 1811. I place my hand on this abstract clay, a reluctant gazetto that I bought for you, Miss Talman, on a rain-swept Giron quay. Who knows which officer of the Empire, which prelate of the Gallican Church, placed it on a northbound car, filled and creaking like a kidnapped pope. Out of Civitavecchia once, the frigate of Europe fled with art. I found it on sale near the Barton Wine, all business done, thinking of you. My hand grew warm upon its abstract and unfinished form. I thought of your love, the warmth of sacrament, harmony, pressed open by the arc of our marriage. 15 years this peace has graced our room, as certain faithful as the morning sun rises behind our Masnavi wall. I prefer its unfinished clay to Canova's more perfect Cupid and Psyche. There is, beloved Miss Talon, a contrapuntal harmony we recognize as vulnerable as unfinished art. I would not claim a perfect unity for us, mere humans that we are, any more than kingdoms far apart. Slim, adolescent limbs that promised much are like an unbroken, in an unbroken marital sense, are like idyllic, mystical union embodied here, born of Italian clay, and overnight, yet deeper.